Hey there, it's Lars. Thanks for checking out the Lars Larson podcasting experience, and have a fantastic day.
And let the word go forth all over the world that a jury of 11 whites and one black in the deep south stood up in the courtroom and said that black lives do matter.
That, of course, is Al Sharpton, and this is the Lars Larson Show on the eve of Thanksgiving 2021. Welcome to the program, and I just want to wish that all of you have a wonderful Thanksgiving and that you remember all of the wonderful things that God has blessed this great country with. But Al Sharpton could not be happier, although what's interesting about this case involving father and son Gregory and Travis McMichael and their neighbor William Roddy Bryan found guilty of felony murder today in the shooting death of Ahmaud Arbery, a black man who was running through their neighborhood back in February of last year when the three defendants chased him down the street, confronted him, and then murdered him. The three men are facing up to life in prison. That will be decided later. Here's the way it went down in a courtroom in Brunswick, Georgia, just hours ago. Take a listen.
Verdict is as follows. In the Superior Court of Glynn County, State of Georgia, the State of Georgia versus Travis McMichael, case number CR000433. Jury verdict form. Count one, malice murder. We, the jury, find the defendant, Travis McMichael, guilty.
And on all the other charges, Travis McMichael was found guilty. If you heard that outburst in the court, the judge wasn't having any of it. He had that person escorted out of the courtroom. You'd think that people would understand that is not the way you behave in a courtroom. But I've got a take on this all the way back to when we first learned about this case in the early part of last year. So a year and a half ago now, it seemed very, very clear this man had been murdered. He'd done nothing. And I know that there were comparisons that were made to the case of Kyle Rittenhouse that was decided last week. But the fact is that this man's situation was entirely different. He was running through a neighborhood in broad daylight. The crime was actually videoed. Now, local law enforcement appeared to use the good old boy rule because members of the McMichael family had been working in law enforcement, and there were some ties there that I think that led to the local police and others not taking any action at all. But boy, when the action happened, it came very, very quickly. And I think that justice was a guilty finding in the case of the McMichael father and son and their buddy, Roddy Bryan, who were all found guilty of felony murder. Roddy Bryan found guilty of felony murder. Now, so you understand, if you agree to take part in a murder, if you agree to take part in a crime, if you take part in a crime, whether you're the person who pulled the trigger or not, you can be found guilty of felony murder. Now, there were different findings for the different defendants, but the fact is, all three of these guys were guilty of felony murder. They probably should go to prison for the rest of their lives. And I'd say that about any murderer, no matter what. But in this case, at least we didn't see the kind of outrageous conduct that we've seen after other legitimate jury verdicts, like for example, the riot in Portland last Friday night, after the also correct verdict in the Kyle Rittenhouse case. In any case, it's a Wednesday heading up to Thanksgiving, and because of that, we're going to treat this like a First Amendment Wednesday. I'm going to open up the phone lines, and if you want to unload, if you simply want to say what you're thankful for, I'm glad to have you do that. And if you want to jump into the best conversation in talk journalism, it's right here at 866-HEY-LARS. That's 866-439-5277. Emails go to talk@LarsLarson.com. I want to mention something else because we've got a lot, actually, for heading up to a holiday. Ordinarily, the news cycle kind of slows down in a holiday week. It certainly has not done that today. But here's a question I don't know if you're going to see framed this way anywhere else. Are other states in America scooping up a lot of really great talent that both Oregon and Washington have abandoned? Now, over the last 2 months or so, you've heard on this show, as doctors, nurses, cops, firefighters, paramedics, these are essential workers, and many of them have been shown the door simply because they said, I'm not willing to take the vaccination, which should be their right to make the decision. That has always been the position of this show. If you want to get the vaccine, get the vaccine. If you don't want to get the vaccine, that should be an equally valid choice, and you should not be forced into it. But In a few moments, I'm going to give you my thoughts on the new electronic vaccine passports that are coming for 2 out of the 3 Pacific Northwest states. Are you ready for that? To have somebody say, well, let's see your papers. If you want to go shopping, if you want to go to a restaurant, if you want to go to any kind of public event, if you want to travel, if you want to spend money, if you want to eat, if you want to shop, you have to show us your papers, except now it's going to be an electronic database of those who are vaccinated and those who are not. I'll give you my take on that coming up shortly. But Oregon has about 15,000 missing healthcare workers in the industry. And one of the larger hospitals, as pointed out by the Oregon Taxpayers Association, one of the largest hospitals in Southern Oregon has just closed. And they've laid off hundreds of people. You know what they're doing in Montana? The governor there, Greg Gianforte, is offering healthcare professionals as much as $12,500 cash to relocate to his state. And Tennessee is out shopping for law enforcement people. They're saying, move to Tennessee. We don't care if you're vaccinated or not. We consider that your choice. Montana is now luring new nurses. Oregon has occupational laws that effectively block the nurses from other states from easily locating or resuming employment in the state of Oregon. So when you hear that your local healthcare folks are understaffed, that was a choice. It was a choice both by the governor of the state and by the people who ran those healthcare institutions. When they tell you, oh, we're short of staff and we don't know what to do about it, I think you should suggest to them, maybe you shouldn't have thrown away all of those doctors and nurses and paramedics and the like. By the way, Montana's attorney general has been fighting the federal employee vaccine mandate. Oregon has been enacting a vaccine mandate even more strict than the one that Joe Biden adopted and then was thrown out by the federal courts. Consider that picture. You've got a president who has used illegal and unconstitutional moves to try to force a vaccine mandate. You've got governors like Jay Inslee and Kate Brown that have done the same. You've got federal courts that have thrown out the OSHA vaccine mandate. And then you've got governors saying, we're going to double down on that and make it even tougher than it is in the rest of the country. That is absolute nonsense as far as I'm concerned. In any case, glad to have your phone calls and your emails on a First Amendment Wednesday heading up to Thanksgiving. And as I said, I hope that all of you have a wonderful gathering with your families. I hope you don't listen to Dr. Fauci. And by the way, our parody guy, Jim Gossett, he's got a new song for Dr. Fauci. You may want to stick around for that a little bit later on this hour. And then next hour, we're going to hear from Ted Nugent. And he's got a little musical treatment and a message for some of the people in government when they decide to come and take your freedoms away. The numbers, if you want to join in, are 866-HEY-LARS. And, of course, naysayers will go right to the head of the line at 866-439-5277. Emails go to talk@LarsLarson.com. And electronic vaccine passports are coming for 2 of the 3 Northwest states. My take on that nonsense coming up on the Radio Northwest Network on this eve of Thanksgiving 2021. You're listening to the Lars Larson Show.
That makes a lot of sense. A lot of nonsense.
Right. You're bloody well right. You know you got a right to say.
This is the Northwest Nonsense.
How much longer do we have to sit for this nonsense?
No left-leaning, dead fish rapper bias. No mega TV network liberal agenda. Just the cold hard facts from Lars.
Well, Kate and Jay surely know how to play the game. The Northwest governors have acted like dictators the past 600 days, deciding that royalty like them have no need to consult with the people's representatives. Why would they? But like any bad king and queen, they often sense when the peasants are getting restless. Yesterday, Kate Brown's hapless health authority announced it's dropping the rule for wearing masks in outdoor spaces, which I've noticed personally, most folks aren't following that rule anyway. And then, big surprise, both state governments confirm they're working on electronic vaccine passports for citizens. Now, they're smart enough not to call them by the P word, passport, and most news reports you see and hear today will not either. Shiny, helpful, happy, convenient QR codes and electronic verification systems that you load up on your smartphone. Ain't that just cool? Only some of us have been warning about the "your papers, please" style authoritarian governments that Kate Brownshirt and her hapless friend Jay Inslee seem to like so much. The same two Democrats who steadfastly refuse to make voters show ID to cast a ballot now want you and your vital statistics loaded up in a state database, which can be checked from anywhere and probably by anyone if you plan to work, shop, eat, or travel, or probably even breathe. But you can stop wearing that mask outside. Yeah, the one you weren't wearing anyway. I hope that you and yours have a wonderful, happy Thanksgiving with your family and friends, and remember all the ways that God has blessed this exceptional country. And now today's Daily Grill.
Insane.
Are you completely insane?
Ridiculous.
They get more and more ridiculous.
Flat out dumb.
You're even dumber than I thought.
Who deserves today's Lars Grill of the Day?
Maybe they're just really, really stupid.
Find out right now. Brought to you by Les Schwab Tire Centers. Doing the right thing matters.
Well, last year, when I warned you about the crazy decision in Washington State, in Washington, it was the courts that effectively legalized hard drugs. In Oregon, it was the voters in Measure 110 who effectively legalized hard drugs. And I told you I was going to be telling you the true cost of this crazy decision. Get this. King County has now agreed to pay a settlement of $1.25 million. A man had gone to jail because he was accused of driving under the influence. Now, that's a serious charge. He was only in jail for about 20 minutes. His name is Abdulwali Mussi. He had broken bones in his face, broken teeth, and a traumatic head injury. Why? Because another guy, Carl Allen Anderson, a man with mental illness and a criminal history, oh, and by the way, went into a meth-fueled rage and beat up the man who was the DUI suspect. So King County is going to pay out $1.25 million of your money to compensate that man for the kind of damage he suffered. This is one of the consequences and one of the side effects of all that hard drug legalization. Today's best email, but you can always send more to talk@LarsLarson.com, is brought to you by River City Environmental, the leading environmental and emergency services company in the Northwest, now hiring with full benefits, leading pay, and a signing bonus, online at RiverCityUSA.com/careers. Chris Baroker writes in, "Lars, I've been a cop for 26 years. I've seen this craziness in our country, let alone all over the nation. We let these animals out. They're career criminals, and the criminal justice system keeps giving them a break, like letting this guy," he's talking about Daryl Brooks in Waukesha, Wisconsin, "out on $1,000 bail after running over his wife with a car. Crazy thinking. These poor families in the parade route on Sunday night that have lost loved ones because of this idiot's actions should own the county, if not the state, the prosecuting attorney's office, and the prosecutor that let him get out on $1,000 bail. Those people responsible for letting this guy out need to be held accountable." Signed, Chris. Chris, thanks very much for that. We're going to treat this like a First Amendment Wednesday, but first, I want to wish a happy Thanksgiving to my great friend Dylan Honkoop, who's communications director for a group called Save Family Farming. He's got a history in radio as well. Dylan, welcome back to the program, because I want you to talk about something very important. But in the meantime, happy Thanksgiving to you and yours.
Well, thank you very much. Same to you and yours, Lars. But it's not going to be a very happy Thanksgiving, unfortunately, for some of the folks up here. I don't know. I think people have seen the images on the news. We've had a terrible flood up here the past week, and a couple of cities have been ravaged by this, farms, et cetera. Hundreds of people left homeless by these terrible floods up here in Sumas and Everson and Whatcom, and some in Skagit County as well. It's going to be a rough Thanksgiving for those folks, and there are people still who have lost everything that are relying on emergency shelters to have a roof over their head for this Thanksgiving. Now, why do I bring this up? Because at the same time, a crazy extremist left-wing group based in Bellingham, wonderful hotbed of progressive activism, is pushing to close one of those emergency shelters. They want to shut it down. They want to defund this emergency shelter in the midst of one of the biggest community crises we've had here in decades up in this area. Why? All because of a political beef they have with the farm that had the housing. It was their off season, so workers weren't staying there. It was a great option for people to have safe, good housing over their roof over their heads. But this group says the farm is no good. They're bad. They've falsely claimed over and over that the farm killed a worker, which has been disproven years ago. But their continuing quest to try to unionize farm workers, they have an axe to grind, and they're going so far as to try to force flood victims out of emergency housing to prove a political point here right now.
You know, and we're talking about the man who died was an illegal alien worker, was he not?
I don't know his immigration status. I know he'd been listed as a former farm worker, so I don't even know what his current employment was. But it should be also noted that, you know, the emergency housing that we're talking about being used on this farm here in the Sumas, Washington area is housing mostly just general community members. There are some farm workers there, but the majority of the folks there aren't even necessarily connected to the farming community that are relying on this facility that these activists are now targeting and trying to shut down in the middle of a disaster.
All of this, even though the housing's available, nobody's getting displaced by this, and you are taking people who have been displaced by the flooding in Whatcom and other counties and putting them in there just for a short time before they get back on their feet. And this group wants to kick them out into the cold?
Apparently, they're calling and they're sending emails, making posts on social media, lobbying people. They're even threatening to pack an important community flood meeting tonight over this issue, trying to get the county here, Whatcom County, to defund their support for this. The county just covering, you know, reimbursing the costs of the farm to have this. They aren't making any money on it. That's another one of the accusations is, well, this farm is just doing this to profit off of it, which is laughable. And here we are in the middle of a crisis. But at the same time, I will say there's a community uproar building over this as people see this group's true colors now, that they could care less about the fact that people have no roof to put over their head. They have a political axe to grind, and they're going to do that regardless of the cost. The group is called Community to Community Development, and they are an extremist labor group that will.
Dylan, I've got to cut it off at that point, but you have a wonderful, happy Thanksgiving. Coming up, your phone calls, your emails on a First Amendment Wednesday. Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. It's the Wednesday heading up to Thanksgiving tomorrow, and it's a pleasure to be with you. Happy Thanksgiving in advance to all of you, and a happy Thanksgiving to my friend Nigel Jaques, the Pulitzer Prize-winning reporter for Willamette Week. Find the stories at WWeek.com. Nigel, it's good to have you back, by the way.
Happy Thanksgiving, Lars. Good to be back.
Hey, before we talk about Zillow, I wanted to mention, how long have you been in the news business now? Because this hasn't always been your profession, but you've done very, very well at it. Has it been 20 years?
It's been 23 years.
Wow. Now, you know that reporters usually sit around waiting for even numbers to come up. They'll say this is the 10th anniversary, and then they wait till the 25th, then they wait till the 50th. Do you know what anniversary this is for Thanksgiving?
No.
It's 400. It's 400. And I had a friend of mine point that out to me. First one was in 1621. And you say, hold on a second, 400th anniversary? And that doesn't get significant notice? You know, like the 40th anniversary of Mount St. Helens last year and other major anniversaries that end in a zero or a five. Usually reporters wait for that. In any case, I thought I'd mention it today. Let's talk about what's going on in the Portland housing market, which has gone kind of crazy for values. And Zillow came in and was buying like crazy, and then they stopped. And the question is, what are they going to do next, and what kind of effect is it likely to have on the people listening to this show who might be out there trying to shop for a house right now, and they found themselves in competition with Zillow over the last year, and now Zillow owns a ton of real estate. What are they going to do with all that?
Well, they do own, I think, 7,000 houses around the country. I think they've got a little less than 200 of them in Multnomah County. They own them in Washington and Clackamas counties. They got into what people call the iBuying business in 2019. They use an algorithm instead of eyeballs to put a value on a house. And the advantage they have, of course, they could buy for cash. They could move very quickly. So they acquired lots and lots of homes all around the country. They bought more than 15,000 homes. What they decided in October, announced it in November, was that their algorithm didn't actually work. They were paying too much for the houses. So now they're getting out of the business. They are laying off 2,000 people in that business, and they've got a lot of inventory that they're going to need to sell.
Now, ordinarily, Nigel, when you tell me that, you're more of a numbers guy even than I am, because you know numbers a lot better than I do. You'd say, oh, it's time for a fire sale. That could actually work out well for potential buyers out there. But should I draw that conclusion, or is it a little too hasty to go that direction?
I think it's probably too hasty. They paid, you know, we wrote about a house this week that they bought in North Portland. They paid probably $50,000, $60,000 too much. So, you know, it's a little bit like when you see some of these misleading advertisings about sales, that they paid too much in the first place. So whoever buys that house will probably get it at a fair value. And the scope of the housing market in this country remains massive. And while Zillow is a big company and they bought a lot of houses, they really were a tiny, tiny fraction of the overall market. I actually think the people who are going to suffer most from this are people who wanted to sell their houses in a hurry, because Zillow and two or three others in that space, you know, they've got cash. They buy your house today and you don't have to worry about anybody getting a mortgage. You don't have to worry about waiting 30 or 45 days to close. They were taking houses off people's hands immediately. So that's going to be tougher if you're a flipper yourself.
Well, it was great for the people who sold their house to Zillow if they made 50 grand more than the house was really worth. It was probably even great for people who had a house that was for sale that Zillow didn't buy if the action of Zillow caused the prices to get pushed up on everything else. But as you say, that means perhaps there are people out there who bought a house at a price that had been inflated by Zillow's activity, and now the inflation is leaking out like a bad balloon, and now they bought a house that cost $50,000 or $100,000 more than it was really worth because of what Zillow did.
Well, I think the real problem that people like companies like Zillow cause is that they were focused around the country on the low end, the entry level houses. And so they were pushing prices up for first-time home buyers or people who were really struggling to you know, get a mortgage together, to get their down payment together. They were pushing up those price points in the lower tier of the market. And I think that's a big deal. I mean, I think we all have friends who have bid on houses in the last year or two and seen, you know, there be 10 buyers and the eventual price is way, way over the asking price. And that, you know, that's not good for people.
Now, tell me this. How much pressure is Zillow under to dump this stuff fast? Are they like the American Evergrande, that company in China that finds itself with too much inventory and prices start to fall? And so they'll have to, or do they have the staying power to say, well, we don't need the money back right away, so we can take our time in selling it back into the marketplace?
It's more the latter. I mean, Zillow is a publicly traded, reasonably strong financial enterprise. When the Evergrande, the company you're talking about in China, was massively, massively over-leveraged, meaning they borrowed vastly more money than they could ever afford to repay. But that's not the case for Zillow. I think Zillow looked around and they said there are a couple of other companies that are doing what we're doing and they're a little better at it than we are, so let's get out of this business. But the underlying fundamental business, which a lot of companies have entered of you know, doing brokerage, real estate listing and brokerage online, I think is a fundamentally good business.
Well, I think so too. In fact, I think it used to be if you had a house, one of the downsides of buying a house was that once you had it, selling it could be a very, very long process. That seems to be accelerating, or is my impression wrong?
No, it's definitely accelerated. The average time on the market is very short. And the other thing is, I mean, historically, people are paying 5 or 6% to sell a house. That's a huge transaction cost when you're talking about, you know, average home prices in the Portland metro area of $500,000 or $600,000. You're paying a lot of money to people. And so Zillow and Redfin and other online operators have put downward pressure on commissions. And, you know, our friends who are real estate brokers, and we all have friends who are real estate brokers, aren't happy about that. But those commissions have been pretty fat for a long time.
Now, Nigel, heading up to Thanksgiving, I don't want to think people are unkind, but about every year we hear about somebody who gets in their car, turns on the GPS to go someplace they'd never gone, and they say, well, the GPS led me way up in the mountains somewhere and I got myself stuck. And you say, well, why did you follow that ridiculous piece of equipment instead of using your eyeballs and your brain? I guess I have to ask that of Zillow. Zillow's in the computer business. They're in the business of dealing with this. And they followed a computer algorithm right over a cliff, not a big cliff, but a cliff to some extent?
Yeah, a substantial cliff. I think that they did what a lot of people have done is, as you point out, they put too much faith in machinery and not enough faith in experienced brokers. I mean, I'm not knocking real estate brokers when I say commissions are fat, because, you know, those are the people who drive around town and look at every house, and they can tell you what a house is worth, and they can tell you why, and they know what a house's problems are. And a machine is going to have a hard time knowing that the plumbing wasn't done to code, or that, you know, there's a sinkhole in the backyard, or there's so much traffic noise it looks beautiful online, but you'll go crazy if you buy the house. And I think that there will remain an important human element in single family or in residential real estate for as long as there's residential real estate.
Nigel Jaques is the Pulitzer Prize winning reporter from Willamette Week. You can find the story online at WWeek.com. And Nigel, have a wonderful Thanksgiving.
Same to you, Lars, and to all your listeners.
Thanks very much. Now let's go to Christine. Hey, Christine, we're going to treat this like a First Amendment Wednesday because we're heading up to a holiday tomorrow. What's on your mind today?
Hey, thank you for taking my call. And I just want to say that I heard you say it's a First Amendment Wednesday, but I'm actually calling about Thanksgiving.
Would you mind, Christine? Christine, I miscalculated, but I'm going to hold you through the break. Would you mind if I did that so you have enough time to make the whole point you're going to make?
Of course not.
I'm always thankful for more time and a cooperative caller. We'll be back in a moment. You were live on the Radio Northwest Network. Glad to get your calls at 866-HEY-LARS. And sometimes, well, sometimes I look at the clock wrong. We'll be back in just a moment. You've got the Lars Larson Show. Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. It's a pleasure to be with you. I got a little Jim Gossett parody coming up in a moment, but Christine, I looked at the clock wrong. I do it every now and then. I'm getting to be old and decrepit these days, so I appreciate you holding through the break. You are about to talk about Thanksgiving help. Welcome back, and tell me what's on your mind.
Thank you, and me too. I out of respect for you, I want to tell you that I am what you would probably call a flaming left-wing liberal.
God bless you.
God
bless you. You help me make my living.
That's right. I am a native Oregonian, as is my parents, and I just want to offer a simple little ray of happy from my tiny little blip of a human life. This Thanksgiving, we have a huge extended family, and they range politically and vaccinatedly all the way from me to very, very conservative. And in the middle somewhere is my 1950s gentle conservative parents. And this holiday, you know, some people are getting together where they can and they're not where they aren't. And some of us are staying and cleaning up our Bluebird school bus and painting. But, you know, we all are doing it respectfully and lovingly, and it's really cool, you know. Not everybody has
I think that's
opinion,
nice.
But when we get together, it's,
yeah.
You know, we do it. And
No one got disinvited from Thanksgiving, from the Thanksgiving gathering because of their politics, left or right?
Definitely. Nope. And same with earlier this year, my dad passed away and we all got together. We respected each other. You know, we knew it was a family time, and that's what you do.
You know what? I can give you a great Thanksgiving Day story if you want to bring the whole family together, because as you said, you come from the far left and some of your family comes from the far right. Can I tell you a Thanksgiving story that will make
it.
your far right friends' hearts go pitter pat?
Yeah.
Okay. Do you know that there almost wasn't a second Thanksgiving?
Well, sure.
It was a tough time, and here's why it happened. 1621. This is the 400th Thanksgiving, and why most of the media isn't calling it
quadcentennial.
Is that what they call it? Bicentennial, quadcentennial, and then we have to wait 100 years for the centicentennial.
And if we're both here, I'll wish you a happy one.
Well, I hope you are here. I don't know about me, but if you are here, I would be happy to wish you one in advance. Here's the story you can tell that will impress all of the right end of your family. The first Thanksgiving happened, and then the next year, the pilgrim, the some of the colonies, the first folks who had Thanksgiving, almost died of starvation. And do you know why?
They didn't know how to farm.
Well, no, they knew how to farm. But what they had done was something that was very human. It sounds very compassionate. They said, why don't we operate as a commonwealth? And there are still states that are called commonwealths, like Virginia. And they said, everybody will work and we'll all work just as hard. And then everybody will put into the community storehouse. And then we will all, you know, eat dinner and get our housing and food and clothing and everything else from the community storehouse. And they counted on everybody would work just as hard, even if what they did not necessarily come back to them, but came back to the whole community. How do you suppose that sounds like it might work out for somebody who's a self-declared far-left liberal?
Well, you know what I'm going to say.
What are you going to say? Okay, it sounds great. Do you know what happened? Somewhere about the middle of that year, about the time that maybe one of the conservative members of your family was out sweating his brains out in the field or sweating her brains out, working and cooking and cleaning and all that stuff, they realized, you know what? The layabouts in our community are getting just as good a dinner, just as good a stuff as the people who work hard. And you know what? They resented that. And they said, we don't like this because I work my tail off and he or she doesn't do much of anything and they get the same I do. And it almost fell apart and they literally almost starved the following winter. And then right after that, they came to their senses and the governors of these little colonies said, you know what? We're going to divide up the land. And Christine, you get the same size piece of land as Lars. If Lars grows a gigantic garden, Lars can eat that food. He can feed his family with the food. He can sell or trade it to other people in the Commonwealth. He can do whatever he wants with it, but it's his food. And they did that with everyone. Do you know what happened after that?
I love it. And as a gardener and a liberal who likes to work hard just for the fun of it, I love it too.
Do you know what happened after that? They had prosperity after that because they threw socialism out the window and they embraced capitalism.
Oh, I do want, I forgot to say, when I say I'm a left-wing liberal, I'm not a Democrat. I've never been a Democrat. They totally screwed the people, always. But, you know, that's...
So are you to the left of the Democrat Party?
Definitely.
You are? You're over there with Bernie Sanders and AOC?
Oh, gosh, yes. But, you know, we get together somewhere in the middle. But, you know, it's not like I don't like to work. I like to work, but... you know, I get it. What's really cool is when we can see that we're both searching for the truth and we really, really, really will be happy when we find it. But we're not judging each other along the way, you know?
Happy Thanksgiving, Christine. Thanks very much for the call. Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. It's a Wednesday heading up to the 400th Thanksgiving in 1621, the first one, and of course this one, 2021. We're going to treat this like a First Amendment Wednesday as we head up to a major American holiday. And I want to wish Daniel Ortner a happy Thanksgiving. Daniel, how are you?
Lars, happy Thanksgiving to you too.
And Daniel is a lawyer with a group called the Pacific Legal Foundation, a constitutional law lawyer, and he's one of our favorites. I want to talk to Daniel about a very strange thing that Oregon has done. The state of Oregon has banned what are called love letters written by people who want to buy a house and who think, if I write a letter telling the seller of the house how much I love this house and what good care I will take of the house, maybe that'll give me an edge. And in a competitive real estate market, it could be. And then the state of Oregon, I think in violation of the federal constitution, said, you're not allowed to write that love letter. So PLF, Pacific Legal Foundation, is actually taking this one to court, aren't you, Daniel?
Yep, that's right. We filed a lawsuit last week on behalf of Total Real Estate Group, a brokerage, collection of brokers in Bend, Oregon, that use these letters all the time. Their clients use them to communicate to sellers their desire to buy the house. They communicate that they want to live in the house as opposed to buying it to flip it or sell it or rent it out. And sellers...
Daniel, you dropped out on me for a moment there. Sellers or what?
Oh, I'm sorry. I said sellers really care about who buys their house. They want someone who's going to be a good neighbor, to be a good fit for their community, as they're looking for buyers who are going to live in the house. And these letters allow buyers to communicate that.
Okay, so here's the question. I'd love to talk to the people behind this. We haven't been able to get them to come on, but I'd love to ask them, what was the great harm that you saw that made it necessary to actually pass the first state in America to pass a law that bans real estate love letters? To your knowledge, do they have any people who say they've actually suffered some harm, you know, to the point where you'd have to go out and pass a law that would ban these
things? No, there's no evidence. It really is speculation and fear that these letters might allow someone to discriminate. Maybe if someone talks about their family or their race or their sex in the letter, it might allow a seller to discriminate. But there's no evidence for that, but that's a real problem that's happening that requires the government to step in and ban these letters. The chief sponsor in the Oregon legislature admitted, basically, we don't have any real evidence. We were speculating that this is happening. And when the First Amendment is on the line, that's not good enough.
So it's a solution in search of the problem. Does banning these kind of letters potentially discriminate against people and actually cause some harm?
Yes, absolutely. These letters, who they benefit the most are actually underprivileged buyers, especially first-time home buyers who may not be able to compete in terms of the offer, the financing they can offer. And these allow them to have a chance to get a house that they wouldn't otherwise be able to buy. And so it actually harms the people that the state's trying to help. These underprivileged buyers that really need the leg up is actually undercutting them and causing them harm.
Because somebody, I mean, I don't know what the term of art in the industry is, but I would call it mature. Somebody who's a mature home buyer, meaning you've bought and sold houses throughout your house, you built up a bunch of equity, maybe even sold in another state, like let's say California, and you come to Oregon and you say, gee, I sold my less than average house in California for $1 million, and what can I get for that up here? And the real estate folks are going to say, you can get a whole bunch of stuff for that and for a whole lot less than that. So you walk in with cash. You can just write a check in many cases. Those people are probably not writing love letters because they can just walk in and say, I'll give you a pile of cash and I'll write you a check and it's a done deal, right?
Yeah, especially, I mean, if it's an institutional, someone who buys and sells lots of houses for renting purposes, for instance, like a big, like Blackstone, one of those big like brokerages, they don't need these letters. So really it benefits the smaller first-time home buyer who doesn't have enough money or enough savings to get a really big down payment or just needs that chance to compete. When you buy and sell a house, it's more than just dollars and cents. The seller is looking for not just the most financially viable deal, but the best offer. And that could involve making sure that someone's going to be a good fit for the neighborhood, going to be a good neighbor to your neighbors. It could involve if you have an emotional attachment to the house you've lived in, you want to make sure someone is going to cherish it and not just live there.
And, you know, Daniel, after we talked about this the first time when this crazy law first passed, I got a lot of emails from people saying, I've sold a lot of houses and I don't care whether they write me a letter or not. All I want is the maximum amount of money. I understand that. But I want to ask you something. When state legislatures pass laws, they spend a lot of money to employ what are usually called legislative counsel. That means an attorney like you, but not an attorney like you, somebody who actually knows the Constitution. You know the Constitution. When they brought this law to this lawyer that's supposed to look over legislation, whether it's Boise or Olympia or Salem, didn't their lawyer say to them, you can't ban people from writing a letter? That's going to get thrown out of court in a heartbeat. Do you suppose they got that warning?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, you know, it says agents, you can't pass these letters along. It doesn't ban a buyer from going directly to a seller. And so they think that might be what protects it constitutionally. But in reality, I think that makes it more vulnerable because it shows that they're not really going out of their way to go after these letters. They're allowing if someone's really committed to discriminating, they can find ways to do it. But it just bans the most effective, most efficient, most logical way for people to communicate, which is between their brokers that they're using. It doesn't make sense. You know, it's usually not viable to go behind their back, especially if you're from out of state trying to communicate to a seller. And so it's just putting barriers on speech that are unnecessary, and it shows that they're not really that concerned about this ultimately, because they didn't go out of their way to actually, you know, to just make it all legal. They only targeted certain kinds of communications.
Well, and that's it, because look, real estate brokers, they're all about, well, I don't want to pass along a letter if it might cause discrimination. I say, hold on. Isn't your job to communicate any part of the offer that your client, the one who's paying your fee, tells you to pass along? You might say, I don't want that. You know, you could have any kind of communication you want. And if this person's agreed to be your agent, are they allowed to filter what kind, what part of the offer they do and don't communicate?
Well, they do have an obligation. I think agents have an ethical obligation to pass along information, like you said. They also have an obligation to comply with law, with fair housing laws. And actually, I think that that's an important point. Agents actually ensure compliance. They warn buyers or sellers, you know, not to engage in discriminatory conduct. So they're actually an intermediary that helps prevent discrimination. I actually worked as a real estate agent in Boston years ago, and you know, as a rental agent, and I'd often be telling buyers or seller or the owner of the property, you know, this is the law regarding fair housing, regarding pregnant renting and not discriminating against those
or pregnant. Unmarried or all these other categories.
Yeah,
you're not allowed to discriminate.
The brokers
on.
Actually are serving a role, an important role, because they're the ones that know the law. They're the ones that have ethical obligations to it. And so they actually, I think, as intermediaries are very valuable. And so when this
absolutely. Hey, Daniel, I've got to run, but happy Thanksgiving. That's Pacific Legal Foundation constitutional attorney Daniel Ortner.
Have yourself a Fauci little Christmas. Make your contact slide. Faces will be out of sight. Have yourself an isolated Christmas. Stay 6 feet apart. Do not shop until you've sanitized your car. Fauci is such a piece of work. He's a little jerk, for sure. Contradicts himself constantly. How much more can we endure? Through the years we used to be together. That's not allowed. Fauci says that 8 people is now a crowd. So have yourself an isolated Christmas now.
That is our brilliant parody guy, Jim Gossett, on the Lars Larson Show, and it's a real pleasure to be with you on a Wednesday heading up to America's 400th day of Thanksgiving. Thank God for all the wonderful things that we enjoy in this exceptional country. Our Twitter poll today, can the government tell you to wear a mask in your own home? Now, this hasn't happened in the Pacific Northwest yet. In fact, I pointed out earlier that Governor Kate Brown actually yesterday said, you don't have to follow that rule about wearing masks outside anymore if you're near a big, unless you're in a big crowd. And I noticed that most of the people, at least last weekend, didn't seem to be wearing a mask outside anyway, except for those diehards that you always see driving around by themselves in a car wearing a mask. I guess they're protecting the upholstery in their car. But should the government be able to tell you to wear a mask in your own home? Santa Cruz County, California, as we head up to tomorrow's day of Thanksgiving, is imposing an indoor mask mandate, which requires residents to wear masks in private settings, including inside their home and regardless of your vaccination status. That's how crazy they are in Santa Cruz. The mandate applies to gatherings of those who live in different homes but meet together in one location. It's almost like we went in the Wayback Machine all the way back to last Thanksgiving of 2020. It was imposed in light of rising COVID-19 cases in the area. I wonder exactly how they're going to enforce that. If you want to join the best conversation in talk journalism, it's right here. And today's Twitter poll is brought to you by Ultimate Truck Services. If you rely on trucks for business, Ultimate keeps your biggest assets on the road and running right. Find them at ultimatetruckservice.com. 866-HEY-LARS. And if you're a naysayer, even a liberal naysayer, like our friend Christine who called in, I loved that phone call, actually, and I thought it showed great courage on her part to call in. And I hope that some of the members of her family get a chance to share with her their thoughts about what Thanksgiving actually stands for and some of the lessons we might have learned from the first people to come to North America from Western Europe. Let's go first to Jerry. Hey, Jerry, welcome to the Radio Northwest Network on this eve of Thanksgiving. What's on your mind today?
Well, today I say no to that that question you said because I don't see how they're going to enforce it. But my question to you is, have you heard, you had mentioned about these marijuana, illegal marijuana operations in Klamath County. And the issue, November 3rd through the 9th of the Epoch Times, they talked about cartels are using narco slaves on Oregon farms in Josephine County. Are you aware of that article?
Jerry, we've actually had the sheriff from that part of the state.
Yeah. Okay.
We've had the sheriff on. Who actually, in fact, he's in one of the opens to the show where a gentleman says, when you start to have drug dealers dropping off dead bodies in the streets of your town, you know you have a problem. That was from that interview where the only way they found out about the grow, which had more than 100 human slaves, they were also illegal aliens, but they were human slaves first and foremost. But the reason they found out about it was that the farm, which apparently had taken these people captive, illegal aliens, was paying them almost nothing, housing them in extremely unsanitary, unsafe conditions, and Black making farm. Them work. They were slaves by any kind of definition. One of them was in very bad shape, and he was dropped off while still technically alive and at a Chevron, I think it was a Chevron station. They just dropped him at a gas station. And said, you're sick, get out of the car. And he died at the local hospital. And when the sheriff investigated, he found more than 100 human slaves. And you say, well, where is that happening? Some third world country? You say, no, the Pacific Northwest of the United States of America. That's how crazy this is, that all of this, the legalization of pot made this stuff come about. I'm not saying we didn't have illegal grows before. But we now have massive illegal grows. The one you're talking about is one where the police seized 500,000 pounds of pot worth about $500 million, half a billion dollars, and they were using slaves at that one as well. And you, all these people in the woke Pacific Northwest who will tell you all day long about how much they care about human rights and how they want to go after China or Chile or whoever, whatever other country they see, say, hey, how about your own backyard? Where marijuana growing, done illegally, but under the cover, you know, you understand how it's easier to grow pot in a state, both Oregon and Washington, where it's legal to grow it if you do it legally. It's illegal if you do it illegally. But telling the difference between the two, it provides a great cover for the cartels and other criminal organizations to do this kind of thing. And if they do it far enough off the beaten path, they can get away with using human slaves. And this is one of the consequences.
They use these hemp farms to do it. They use these hemp farms to do it undercover. That's what I understand. I'm concerned that maybe Washington State has hemp farms that they're considering doing the same thing to. I blame Biden for this whole thing.
Not Biden. I can't blame Biden for it. I blame the people who voted to have legalized pot or had it passed by the legislature. I can't really find a way to blame that one on Biden. I don't think that would be appropriate.
Well, the migrant workers they're sending up are illegal.
Oh, yeah, the migrant,
coming from California.
Yeah, no, the migrant worker part of it, yes. Human trafficking, when by the end of this year, by the end of next month, will be a 2 million people entering this country. And if you wonder, well, where are those people and how are they getting across? Well, the cartels are bringing them across and they charge thousands of dollars. And you say, well, how does somebody from Guatemala come up with several thousand dollars? They effectively become an indentured servant. They become a slave and they probably work till either they die or the cartels decide that they've repaid their debt. That's the kind of ugly situation. And you are right to blame the illegal alien component of it on Joe Biden. It is the eve of Thanksgiving. It is my pleasure to be with you, and I've turned today into a First Amendment Wednesday. Coming up in a moment, we'll talk to the Motor City Madman, my friend Ted Nugent, who has a new song that's about freedom in America, and we'll get his view on what engineered recidivism is. Yeah, we saw an example of that in Waukesha, Wisconsin. That, of course, is the Motor City Madman, Ted Nugent, a great friend of the show. And, of course, he is the virtuoso guitarist, bow hunter, Second Amendment advocate, teacher in an upcoming rock and roll camp masterclass, and the artist of the new single called Come and Take It from his forthcoming album, Detroit Muscle, which is coming out in the spring. Ted, welcome back to the program. How are you, sir?
Lars, I feel welcome. How about that love song? Huh? Happy Thanksgiving every damn day to everybody out there, man.
I've got a question for you, Ted. And now this is about news media, and I'm in news media. You're in music. But do you know which Thanksgiving tomorrow's Thanksgiving is?
Well, first of all, I want to make it perfectly clear. The Nugent family celebrates Thanksgiving every day, Veterans Day every day, Independence Day every day. We celebrate opening day of deer season every day. So we don't really pay attention to the minutia. We just get into the, shall we say, the throttle storm of every celebration.
Of course you do. And we should be thankful every single day for this exceptional country. But I had a friend of mine write to me and said, Lars, tomorrow's the 400th Thanksgiving, and you know the rules in news. The first anniversary of something is very important, then the 5th, then the 10th. Usually then they skip to the 20th, then it's the 25th. Sometimes they'll skip all the way to the 50th. Why, this is the 50th anniversary, or the 75th. They like numbers that end in either 0 or 5. Tomorrow is the 400th Thanksgiving, and for the life of me, I can't find any media mentioning the fact that this country has before and after it became a country, marked 400 Thanksgivings to God for all the blessings he's showered on this country and the people who live in it.
Well, I know you respect your elders. We've talked about that before, because I'm going to be 73 here in a couple of weeks. So this is officially the 73rd Thanksgiving of this guitar player. But, you know, it really is a sacred time of year that we do not let get away from us. You know, again, I'm just a guitar player, but I was prioritized and disciplined being raised in Detroit, hence the incredible soul music that just spews forth from my very being. But my family was raised literally on bended knee, because the whole world sucks. America still sucks less. Boy, we're catching up quick. But I got to tell you, I'm surrounded by smart, dedicated, prioritized people, and we carve out a perfect American dream, especially during the hunting season. Like, this is the best hunting season of my life. But everyone should realize that Thanksgiving is November, because we're thanking God for the gift of life that is manifested in the renewability of the hunting, fishing, and trapping conservation lifestyle. So when I say we celebrate it every day, you know I mean it.
Now, I got to tell you something, Ted. You sent a message out, not just to me, but to a lot of the other folks who do what I do. And one of my listeners spotted it as soon as it went up and sent it to me and said, hey, Ted had a message for you. You better do what he tells you to do. And I like your new, the term you coined, engineered recidivism. I knew him exactly what you were talking about, but I thought that is a really wonderful term of art, especially in light of what happened in Waukesha, Wisconsin on Sunday night. Would you mind explaining what you wanted to get across by coining that term and then throwing down the gauntlet and say, Larson, you start using this term? And I did that very day.
And I knew you would, and I knew you didn't need any explaining, because you've got this grasp of the English language. I always salute you for that. Not just the verbology, but the truth, logic, and common sense. I've been doing media interviews literally for the last 50-some years as a rock and roll guy thrust into the spotlight, and they were always concerned about, how dare I carry a gun? This guitar player actually thinks he can keep and bear arms. He's really radical. And this guitar player, he murders innocent animals. Hey, it's barbecue, you dumb nut. Anyhow, my point is that I constantly am bombarded from good families who are victimized by the engineered recidivism. It, Lars, every study has proven, even the FBI, when they can be trusted, which is almost non-existent right now, but the Uniform Crime Report over and over again for many years from the Federal Bureau of Investigation has proven that upwards of 96%+ of violent crime is repeat violent crime because they let these devils out. And what happened in Waukesha, what happens every day, whether it's in the news or not, is people are victimized by engineered recidivism, where our anti-justice failed court system, the judges and the prosecutors and the parole boards, they knowingly unleash devils into our neighborhoods, rapists, murderers, stabbers, shooters, carjackers, child molesters. They know they're going to do it again, and they let them out anyway. I hope everybody listening right now will call their mayor, their senator, their congressman, and their governor and tell them to stop the engineered recidivism. That's what we're living with today.
And just to explain, I mean, Ted, I became a reporter. I've been in this business 46 years. I started covering stories. And when you talk to the cops and the judges and the prosecutors, and they say recidivist or recidivism, or we're worried about, I I've got to learn what that means. And they said it means you did it again, except saying a criminal did it again is kind of clunky, and recidivist or recidivism is kind of handy. And like you, I've been reading the Uniform Crime Reports by the FBI. Not so crazy about the rest of the agency, but the numbers are really handy. And you're right. And you would think, Ted, wouldn't you think that Daryl Brooks, who has a right to his day in court, he's only accused of 5 murders, soon to be 6, because the people died in Waukesha on Sunday night. And he is only accused of the crime. He hasn't been convicted yet. But this guy, earlier this month, is accused of, again, beating the mother of his child and then deciding to run over her with a car. And then shortly after he bailed out on a meager $1,000, gets in another vehicle and decides to drive it down a parade route in which the videos seem to suggest he was deliberately hitting people with his car. So I think that'll be determined at trial and probably by the charges. But he's accused of at least 5 counts of murder. I don't know if they've amended it with the 6th one, the child who died yesterday. They knew what this guy was all about. He had a 20-year-long rap sheet.
Well, worse than the rabid coyote are the fools that don't shoot him. And that's a metaphor, ladies and gentlemen. I'm not recommending shooting anybody. I'm recommending if a rabid coyote is foaming at the mouth on your porch, shoot the coyote. I don't want to hear a report about the coyote. I don't want to hear about the next child that's bit by the coyote. I want the coyote out of our lives. And these prosecutors, listen to the evil spewing from these prosecutors who have admitted in Waukesha, Wisconsin, we know our diversion of prosecution will cause innocent lives to be lost, but I still stand by diverted prosecution. Lars, what species, what devil thinks like that and then implements such evil? And I'll tell you who. Prosecutors like the punks in Kenosha, prosecutors like the punks in Chicago, in Seattle, in Portland, in New York. I'm telling you, these prosecutors are literally celebrating evil while condemning the victims. It's literally the world turned upside down in the most egregious and obscene fashion.
It is. You've got to check out the new song, Come and Take It, Molon Labe, if you want to use the old term. Off the new album, Detroit Muscle, by my friend Ted Nugent. Ted, I know every day is Thanksgiving and every day is Independence Day for many of us, but happy Thanksgiving to you, and I appreciate the time today.
Always, Lars. God bless. Godspeed, man. Everybody, take a deep breath, and let's fix this country together. Go to HunterNation.org. HunterNation.org.
And shoot straight, Ted. Shoot straight. You got to get dinner on the table. Back in just a moment. Glad to get your calls. 866-HEY-LARS. You're listening to the Lars Larson Show and the Radio Northwest Network. Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. It's a pleasure to be with you. And our Twitter poll today, can the government tell you to wear a mask in your own home? At least Kate Brown had the smarts to say, nobody's following my outside, or few people are following my outside mask mandate. So she dropped that yesterday. And I would hope that she she understands that many people are not following her mask mandate indoors either. But the question is, can the government tell you to wear a mask in your own home? It almost takes us back to Thanksgiving of last year. But happy Thanksgiving to all of those of you, and I hope you have a wonderful celebration on tomorrow, America's 400th anniversary of Thanksgiving. But can the government tell you to do that? Santa Cruz County, California, is now telling people that beginning last Sunday night, there is a countywide indoor mask mandate, even in private settings like homes. Now, I think that's lunatic. And when people have said, well, how are they going to enforce that? Well, the government, under Democrat governments, you know that there's going to be a whole lot more spying than there ever was under Republican governments. But I think that's how they plan to do it. I remember all the cute little memes last year of Kate Brown looking inside people's windows during Thanksgiving and Christmas, checking to make sure that all the citizens or subjects, as she may think of them, were actually following her dictates. You can find today's Twitter poll at Lars Larson Show, and always brought to you by Ultimate Truck Services. If you rely on trucks for business, Ultimate keeps your biggest assets on the road and running right. Find them at ultimatetruckservice.com. To your calls now. Let's start with Lance. Hey, Lance, welcome to what we're calling First Amendment Wednesday, heading up to Thanksgiving tomorrow. What's on your mind?
Hey, Lars, first, happy 400th Thanksgiving, buddy.
Happy Thanksgiving right back to you and yours.
And then right back, you know, again, I think the Nugent Larson card would be great. I got to tell you, you know, what's going on in this country is so wrong. I live in Portland, Oregon. And this district attorney, Mike Schmidt, the spineless guy that he is now trying to hire four district attorneys so that he can act like he's doing the right thing. He didn't have a spine during it. He couldn't act during all the 100 nights of violence that was going on in Portland. And I got to tell you, if I was a business owner, I'd be suing that guy. I'd be going after him personally, legally, any way that I could. This is disgusting. This country was a great country, and now acts like this, our leaders that are in our offices are acting like they're against us. I don't feel like I belong in this country anymore.
You know what, Lance? We can turn this around, but it's going to take a lot of effort. And that's why it disappoints me when people say, I'm not going to vote, I'm not going to be involved, it's gotten too much. You're not saying that, but I've had other people say it. But I'll tell you that Mike Schmidt, the social justice warrior, is as bad as you say, and then some. And let me give you the and then some. When he came into office and he was allowed to come in early, his predecessor actually checked out early, and Schmidt came in August instead of coming in the early part of this year. He came in August of last year. And one of his first acts was to say, I'm going to decline to prosecute literally hundreds of criminal cases. So he did act. He actually acted in the opposite direction. Rather than saying, I'm not going to put a lot of effort into prosecuting, he actually took cases that were already made and said, I'm not even going to take them to court. So it was bad that way. Second way he was bad, and you're right about the four, he says, oh, I have to have more resources to prosecute all these cases. What about the hundreds of cases you said you're not going to do anything about at all? Then he hired a man to come in, and I kid you not, the prosecutor's office is supposed to prosecute people, and they should do it legitimately. They should look at every case and say, this man should be or woman should be prosecuted, this one should not. And they have to make choices like that all the time. He hired a guy for over $200,000 a year who then ended up, I guess, causing some HR problems, but he left the office. But his job was to unprosecute people. That is, not current cases. Mike Schmidt actually hired this guy and said, your job is to go back and find old cases where the person was already charged, already indicted, already put on trial, already has had his or her appeals, most of them were guys, and find a way to unprosecute them. Now, that's how crazy he is. And the voters are putting up with it. And I don't know that we have much choice at this point. Portland does not seem inclined to get rid of this guy. And yet, a prosecutor who says, I'm not going to prosecute actual crimes, a prosecutor who says, I'm going to hire somebody with your money to unprosecute people who've already been successfully prosecuted and put in jail or at least convicted of a crime. That's how lunatic this is. And of course, the bad guys get the message. Daryl Brooks, the guy who's charged in Waukesha, has the same kind of DA in that county, John Chisholm, who's bragged about how he wants to reduce the amount of bail. He wants to get it to zero if he possibly can. He doesn't think we should hold people in custody. We should just turn them loose. And he couldn't look at Daryl Brooks and say, this is a man who's on the sex offender registry in Nevada. He's got previous felonies he's committed and been convicted of. He was recently caught with a gun as a convicted felon in possession of a gun. And anytime a felon has a gun, I assume that felon is more likely than most people to use it in committing another crime. And then he's accused earlier this month of beating up the mother of his child and running over her with a car. And what do they say? Let him go on $1,000 bail. And then he is now accused of committing the horrendous crime that happened on Sunday night. And this guy is a man who has posted things about hating white people. He has posted things about BLM. It was a terrorist act in Waukesha, Wisconsin. This hour of the this segment of the show is brought to you by Nick Shivers. Go to nickshivers.com for an instant offer to sell your home immediately. You pick the closing date. nickshivers.com for details, and you've got the Radio Northwest Network. Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. It's a pleasure to be with you, and I'm glad to get to your phone calls and emails. Of course, we've got Thanksgiving coming up. The 400th Thanksgiving on American soil, starting in 1621. So in 2021, we've got 400 Thanksgivings. Try to find a mention of that in any of the mainstream media. But I want to talk to our friend Joe Kent. Now, Joe is seeking a seat in the United States Congress. He is a Republican, and he is running against the sitting Republican, although I refer to Jamie Herrera Butler as a rhino, Republican in name only, because she doesn't much behave like a Republican. But Joe, welcome back to the program. How are you?
I'm doing well. Thanks for having me on, Lars.
Happy Thanksgiving to you and yours. Let me ask you about this. You served in the United States military as a Special Forces warrant officer. You are the husband, the widower of a Gold Star soldier, Shannon Kent, who was killed by ISIS. You're running for Congress, but this is, to a large extent, a local issue. But the horrific crime that we saw in Waukesha, Wisconsin, and come to find out that the man who's accused of this, and I don't think there's any doubt, he will be found guilty. I don't think they're going to have a problem making that case, although he does have a right to his day in court, and the state has to prove the case. But why are we seeing a country where, not just in Waukesha, Wisconsin, but in all parts of the country, including the congressional district you're running in, why are we seeing criminals like this? And liberals saying we should let these people go and leave them out of custody so they can go commit more crimes?
Well, I think the obvious is there's just a lack of law and order in this country. We saw it all last summer as many cities, including Portland and into Vancouver and our district here, you know, burned at the hands of violence that was being condoned by the not just the far left, but by sitting members of the Senate, our current vice president. And they're just members of the left. They've created this environment. And I think especially with the, I mean, there's multiple layers to it, depending on the crime, but especially with the racial type of crime and all this violence, it's really being egged on by the media. They're trying to heighten these racial divisions. We can't point out that this man who committed this crime in Waukesha, that, you know, he was posting things about Black Lives Matter. We can't discuss that at all, even though it's right there in front of our faces. They're calling it, in the mainstream media, they're calling it an accident or a car crash of some sort. It's completely and totally absurd. I think we just have to start acknowledging what's going on here and addressing the problem. The problem is a lack of law and order and a lack of consequences for criminals.
Well, and Joe, I mentioned to people that, you know, CNN had put up a headline saying the suspect in the parade crash. And I thought, right. Parade crash sounds like you're talking about a horrible automobile accident in exactly. which people got hurt or killed. And you say, no, this was an attack on the parade. And as you, I've mentioned that this guy was posting things about Black Lives Matter, about his antipathy toward white people. If you took out his race, he is black, and you replaced him with a white person who had posted things about his antipathy toward people of color, and the same kind of thing. You just flip the situation and say, what would the Chicken Noodle News Network be saying about him? They'd say, he's a white supremacist. He clearly allies himself with these groups, and then he attacks a parade, and if the parade had been predominantly people of color, it was, in fact, predominantly white people in Waukesha, Wisconsin. If you'd had the reverse situation, the mainstream media would be blowing a gasket on this one.
They would be, yeah. And this is just, I mean, more reasons why people can't trust the mainstream media or a lot of our elected officials right now, because Joe Biden has said absolutely nothing about this, whereas he wasted no time when he was a presidential candidate going after Kyle Rittenhouse and calling him a white supremacist, which is completely inaccurate and did nothing but make his trial even more difficult for him to get a fair hearing and further divide the country. But this is the same issue we saw, you know, several years ago as ISIS was launching terror attacks. They couldn't, the Obama administration refused to call radical Islamic terror exactly that. They always had to dance around what it was. I mean, this using a vehicle as a weapon is a tried and true terror tactic, unfortunately. It's literally right out of the Al-Qaeda handbook. So, I mean, to not acknowledge what this man did is just dishonest, and it does nothing but further harm this country.
Joe, mention the website where people can help out your campaign, and then let me ask you this. Mention the website first, but if and when you become a member of the United States Congress, you're going to be in there with people like Rashida Tlaib of Michigan, who's actually proposed that we empty every federal prison in America and let all the criminals inside there out. And I want to know what you think of that.
Yeah, so JoeKentForCongress.com is where folks can go to learn more about me or help us out with the donation. But we have to confront this. I think this is anarcho-tyranny on our streets. We have to actually have the Department of Justice start going after a lot of these criminals, especially criminals that, you know, cross state lines like Antifa and BLM. And then as far as, you know, Rashida Tlaib and the rest of the squad and this crazy abolish the police, empty the prisons, this is not what the American people want. We have to not be distracted by all of the racial nonsense and CRT woke ideology dialogue that they use to try and cover what this actually is. It's an assault on law and order. And then they're going to try and bully around white people and say, look, this is, if you don't agree with this, then you're racist. And, you know, I think a lot of folks have seen what the result is of us being pushed around by this ideology. Look no further than Portland, Seattle, Olympia. When people are too scared to speak out against what they know is wrong, everyone knows this lawlessness is wrong. Don't be distracted by someone saying, well, this is really just supporting racial justice. We have some of the best racial justice in this country of any nation in the history of the world. The story of America is a wonderful story where we envisioned a great republic where all men are created equal. We didn't get there initially, but we have eventually gotten there. And so we can't let this divisive narrative tear us apart. So, and we have to restore law and order to our streets. We owe that to our people.
Well, and I've got to tell you this, Joe, I'm going to be just as tough on you, even though you're a Republican. You get into Congress and you fold up like some Republicans have done. Believe me, I will come after you. At least verbally, because excellent. Here's what really bothers me for people who care. And I even saw Mr. Arbery, you know, Mr. Arbery's father, who came out and said, you know what? It's not just black lives. All lives matter. And I hope the left doesn't decide to cancel him. But the fact is that the people who are the biggest group of victims of these criminals are black and black people and people of other people of color in this country. And that's the dirty little secret that the left doesn't want to admit. Now, when they say we lock up too many black people, well, 60% of the armed robberies in the country, according to the FBI, are committed by people of color. And about 50% of the murders, it's just below that, 48%. And 33% of all non-fatal felony violent crimes are committed by people of color, who number about 6 or 8% of the population, the males anyway. And that's the dirty little secret. If you care about black lives and the lives of people of color, you got to protect them from the criminals that, unfortunately, you know, whether you like it or not, are coming predominantly from the communities of color. So you got to go after those things as well. Joe, I wish you well, and I hope you have a wonderful Thanksgiving. Thanks for coming on the show for a few minutes.
Absolutely. Thank you very much, Lars. Happy Thanksgiving.
And to you as well. Joe Kent, retired Special Forces Warrant Officer and the Gold Star husband of fallen service member Shannon Kent, his late wife, who was killed by ISIS, running to replace Jamie Herrera Butler. And by the way, the Congresswoman is welcome on the program. We'll have her back at some point. A few thoughts on the Arbery case coming up in just a moment, and I'll get to your phone calls and emails. We're treating this on the eve of Thanksgiving like a First Amendment Wednesday at 866-HEY-LARS. That's 866-439-5277.
That a jury of 11 whites and one black in the deep South stood up in the courtroom and said that black lives do matter.
Now, that's Al Sharpton. I don't think Al's going to be making the kind of cash that Al usually gets a chance to cash in on, because the fact is that in the case of father and son Gregory and Travis McMichael and their neighbor William Roddy Bryan, all found guilty just a few hours ago of felony murder in the shooting of Ahmaud Arbery, a man who was running through their neighborhood in February of 2020. And the three defendants, who are white, confronted him. Gregory, McMichael, and Bryan were acquitted of malice murder, but all three men are now facing life in prison. And I know that some of you, and I'm going to go to some calls here in a moment, but some of you are going to say, but this case is almost like the Kyle Rittenhouse case. And let me tell you where there is a gigantic difference between the two cases. Kyle Rittenhouse was last Friday, and the decision was that he had fired in self-defense, that he killed two people and shot and wounded one of them in self-defense. And there's where the center part of the most important issue involved is. The reason I don't think CNN's going to have much to talk about tonight in the Arbery decision is that the Arbery case was pretty clear-cut. I don't hear conservatives saying, well, those three yahoos had a right to chase this man down because he ran through their neighborhood and shot him. In fact, last year when we first became aware of this case that was going on in Brunswick, Georgia, we looked at the situation and said, these guys had no cause to shoot this man. Now, the media wants to focus on Mr. Arbery was black and Kyle Rittenhouse was white. But race wasn't the issue here. The issue was, did Arbery do anything that would have brought about somebody's decision to go after him with deadly force? And the answer was nothing. Nothing at all. No. In Kyle Rittenhouse's case, I know there were people who thought Rittenhouse should have been found guilty, but all the way back to last year, when we saw the videos of what happened that night, that Kyle Rittenhouse was attacked, that he shot only the people who were attacking him, and I said he didn't commit any crime. He shouldn't be charged with a crime. He was. A couple of years of his life have now been taken away, and to some extent, his security for the rest of his life has been taken away, all because the prosecutor decided to charge him because somebody saw that there was a connection between this and the Jacob Blake case, which, remind yourself of the facts of that. Jacob Blake was a thug and a criminal. He fought with the police. He had a weapon, a knife in his hand. He didn't do what the police told him to do. He reached into his car, which means officers are free to say he may be reaching for a weapon, and they shot him. He ended up paralyzed, although, thank God, he's gotten back most of his movement. But he was shot for good reason. And, of course, we had riots after that. And then we had riots after the Rittenhouse case and his shooting of three people who were attacking him. The big difference was Ahmaud Arbery was not attacking anybody, and there was no reason to shoot him. None. And Kyle Rittenhouse was being attacked. And who was he being attacked by? Three white guys. And yet, for some reason, there are people like Sharpton and others who say, we want to make hay while the sun shines, and we want to go after people because we're going to turn this into a case about race, even though everything shouts it had nothing to do with race. Let me go to your calls now at 866-HEY-LARS. We're treating this like a First Amendment Wednesday. Tomorrow is Thanksgiving, and a happy Thanksgiving to all of you. Let's go first to Brett. Hey, Brett, welcome to the program. What's on your mind?
Hey, Lars, how you doing today?
I'm doing quite well today, and happy Thanksgiving to you and yours.
Same to you. So something that bothers me, that there was a caller yesterday, people just can't seem to get over the fact that a 17-year-old grabbed a rifle and crossed state lines to go defend a city or a community.
Except one thing, Brett. I got all kinds of people who wanted to get in the weeds. Rhett wrote to me last night and said he didn't cross state lines with a rifle. The rifle was stored on the other side. There's a lot of real technical stuff. So let's keep it simple. Only because everybody wants to get tied up in the details and say he didn't actually cross state lines with a rifle. Well, of course, a 17-year-old can cross state lines in America anytime he wants. They said, but he did it with a rifle. No, the rifle was stored on the other side of the, and that's why the judge decided to drop that one. I just don't want to end up at the other end of a whole bunch of people who are way off, lost in the weeds, instead of your central point.
No, yeah, and that's not what that's not where I was going with it.
I'm going with is
you have 17 and 18-year-olds that join the military to grab a rifle and go off to defend this country overseas against terrorists. And nobody has anything to say about that. Why is it such a big deal that a kid, I'm a veteran, I served my country, I signed up as a freshman in high school. I wanted to go
Thank
out
you.
And make a difference if we needed to do that. So I don't understand what the difference is. This kid went to defend his community, and he's being absolutely slaughtered over it, and it's just it bothers me so bad.
It bothers me, too, and I'll tell you why, Brett, because there are even conservatives who say, well, what he did was stupid. Actually, I'm going to say, no, it wasn't, and I'm not just doing that to be a contrarian. I'm saying it wasn't stupid because when you understand that your community is under attack, there are ways to fight back, and most of them do not involve firing a gun, although having one with you communicates a message. And I gave the example a couple of days ago of small communities around America where they were told that Antifa or BLM or both were going to show up in their community and have what the news anchors insisted on calling mostly peaceful protests that almost always ended with somebody going to the hospital, something getting broken, something getting burned, and a store getting looted. And some of those small communities said, no, that's not going to happen here. And they showed up, usually in numbers greater than that of Antifa and BLM, and they just stood there. And their mere presence, which police officers will tell you, mere presence is often a very powerful tool. When the cops show up to something that's going on that's illegal and often violent, sometimes just the cops showing up sends all the bad guys away. And if more communities said, when you decide you're going to tear apart our town, that we're going to show up in numbers greater than yours, we're not going to attack you, we're just going to stand there. And when they've done that in smaller communities, it has ended the trouble before the trouble even began. And I think that's what Kyle Rittenhouse had intended. If he had not been attacked that night, and if the crowd didn't attack him, you know, say, we're going to go after him again because he's defending himself, if nobody had attacked him, there wouldn't have been any shots fired. Nobody would have died, and trouble would have stopped. And if there were more people in communities who said, we're not going to do it, if the police have been ordered by their political masters, like it or not, cops have political masters called city councils and mayors. If our cops cannot defend our community, then we will do it by showing up in force. And when you do, the bad things don't happen. What do you think of that?
Well, I would say that we as the people have the right to do that, to protect our, and I don't care what anybody says, I have the right to defend my community. And
yeah,
100% agree.
And if you're doing it simply by being there, I mean, can you imagine all these towns that got torn apart by all these riots? If you'd had numbers greater than the numbers of the so-called protesters show up and just stand around and say, we're here. We don't want you to do this to our community. I think an awful lot of those riots would not have ended with 36 murders, $2 billion worth of damage, things that were set on fire, cops that were called bastards, and all the rest of that. Brett, thanks for the call. You're listening to the Lars Larson Show. Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. It's a pleasure to be with you, and I'm always glad to take your phone calls and your emails. And a real pleasure to welcome to the program Melanie Kirkpatrick, who, think about this for a moment, is the opinion editor for the Wall Street Journal. And to think it all started, what, 41 years ago on the overnight copy desk in Hong Kong, Ms. Kirkpatrick?
I am a past opinion editor, Lars, but yes, it did. I was a copy editor and worked New York hours, which meant I was up all night in Hong Kong.
That's a great place to start and then to rise. Okay, a past copy editor or past opinion editor of the Wall Street Journal and the author of the book Thanksgiving, the Holiday at the Heart of the American Experience. You know, I get calls from people all the time. In fact, I got one today from a young lady who said, I'm a full-blown liberal. And I said, okay, I love talking to liberals. And I told her, I said, my little short, you know, version of Thanksgiving is they had the 1621 celebration and almost didn't have one the next year because the socialist beginnings of the early commonwealths didn't exactly lend themselves to being very productive. But they fixed that pretty quickly and adopted American capitalism. And they ate pretty healthy for hundreds of years after that.
That's a great point. And for me, Lars, the main point about that first Thanksgiving 400 years ago was that it pointed the way to the multicultural and diverse society that we live in today. There were the English settlers, 52 of them, half of their number had died in the previous winter. And then there were 90 Wampanoag braves who all got together and celebrated together for 3 days. They both contributed to the feast, and by the two pilgrim accounts, they seem to have had a good time. And, you know, it was a moment in time of friendship, of fellowship, and of peace. The peace fell apart a number of years later. Their peace treaty fell apart, and, of course, we all know the terrible war, the King Philip's War, that followed later in the century, and also the tragic fate of most Native Americans. So, but those people who like to say we should cancel Thanksgiving because of the American treatment of Native Americans are don't know their history. It was
I wanted to ask you about that, because these days the woke left seems to hate the whole idea of being reminded that there was cooperation between European settlers and Native American tribes. It wasn't always perfect, but what kind of cooperation is perfect?
Yeah, well, the Native Americans provided vital support to the pilgrims, and if it hadn't been for their assistance, there's a good chance they wouldn't have survived. Ronald Reagan was the first to acknowledge the Native American Days of Gratitude in his 1984 proclamation, when he quoted a lovely Seneca prayer. And, I think that was a wonderful thing, and I wish that we could remember that and on this Thanksgiving Day, and instead of I would like us to take a moment to give a thought to the fate of the Native Americans. At the same time, we need to, not let it stand. Not let it continue today. You know, it's a different world today.
Well, and for somebody who's been in the news business as long as you have, and I've been in almost as long as you have, it's something struck me as funny today. Tomorrow is the 400th Thanksgiving for America, and usually I tell people this, there are these weird unwritten rules in news that we always mark the first anniversary of something, like 9/11, and then we usually kind of ease off and then mark the 5th, and then the 10th, and then the 20th, and the 25th, and sometimes we then kind of take a break until a number, either an even number that ends in a zero comes up. I don't even know if I could explain how that makes sense, but people will say, well, why aren't you marking the 27th anniversary of something? I said, because then in the news business, it'll be the 30th, it'll be and then the 40th, and then, of course, the 50th, and on the 100th, that'll be a big deal. Tomorrow's the 400th. When I did a search earlier today, I can find very few news organizations that are reminding people nationwide that tomorrow is the 400th Thanksgiving. Do you have any idea why that is?
I think the progressives who have attacked the holiday in the past few years are having some small impact. Americans love Thanksgiving, and the holiday is not going away. In my view, I don't think that would happen. But, maybe it's a guilty pleasure for some people. And the liberals who run the major media don't want to touch it. This is my interpretation, is that it gets into stuff that is controversial and they don't want to talk about it.
Is religion one of those things, that piece of stuff that goes with it?
I hadn't thought of it, but now that you mention it, yes, that's probably right. There are many threads in the history of Thanksgiving, but religion is the principal one. Of course, we live in a much more secular age. 400 years ago, the pilgrims were champion gratitude givers. They prayed all the time, and at what we call the first Thanksgiving would have been no exception. And by the way, you might be interested in this little tidbit. There are two pilgrim first person accounts of what happened at the first Thanksgiving. And the interesting thing, as I read them, that occurred to me was they don't include the word Thanksgiving. for the pilgrims, the first Thanksgiving was celebrated in 2 years later, in 1623, July, when a drought, when a rainfall ended a drought that was destroying their harvest. So the governor of Pilgrim Colony gave, called a Thanksgiving Day to give thanks for that much-needed rain.
She's literally written the book on it. She is the past opinion editor for the Wall Street Journal, but the book is called Thanksgiving, the Holiday at the Heart of the American Experience. You see, I think that's part of the problem with it, Ms. Kirkpatrick, is that we're giving thanks. And if somebody who's a stranger to our country say, who are you giving thanks to? Well, God. And you say, but what if you don't believe in God? And I say, well, you know, there are a lot of liberals and heathen pagans in this country who don't believe in God. So then who do they give thanks to? I don't know if they know who to give thanks to. Joe Biden?
Well, you know, Ayn Rand wrote about that, and you know, she gave thanks to the farmers and those who helped put the food on the table. That doesn't do it for me. But,
no, it doesn't do it for me either.
I'm thankful for them, but it doesn't do it for me. But I think that the history of Thanksgiving, and this really makes it unique in world societies, is that it's a holiday where people of every faith are welcome at the table, and I would add people of no faith. It's, the individual decides how they're going to be thankful and what they're going to be thankful for and to whom they're going to be thankful. I would guess that, and I can't substantiate this, but I would guess that if there is a day in the calendar when Americans will say grace around the dinner table, it would be Thanksgiving Day.
I would personally hope, Ms. Kirkpatrick, they say grace every single night with dinner as we do. But, hey, you know, to each his own. And it is a free country. Ms. Kirkpatrick, it's a pleasure. That's Melanie Kirkpatrick, past opinion editor for The Wall Street Journal and the author, among other books, of Thanksgiving, the Holiday at the Heart of the American Experience. I'll be back in a moment. You're listening to The Lars Larson Show. Welcome back to The Lars Larson Show. It's a pleasure to be with you. Our Twitter poll today on this eve of Thanksgiving, can the government really tell you to wear a mask in your own home? In Santa Cruz, California, they are imposing an indoor mask mandate that requires residents to wear a mask even in private settings, including your home, and regardless of your vaccination status. That is how far some people in government will take things if you give them the latitude to do that. And what we need to do is take that latitude back. Today's Twitter poll is brought to you by Ultimate Truck Services. If you rely on trucks for business, Ultimate keeps your biggest assets on the road and running right. Find them at ultimatetruckservice.com. And if you're listening on the Radio Northwest Network, I am thankful that for 21 years, this network has served the Pacific Northwest states of Oregon, Washington, and Idaho, and I'm thankful for all 24 of our radio stations that carry this show on a daily basis. Yesterday's poll question was, should Northwest states develop vaccine passports? As it appears, electronic passports are being developed. Oregon is trying to keep it a secret to a large extent. Washington state's being a little bit more open about it. 94% of you said no, and only 6% of you said yes. And there's a legal question. I'm going to see if I can get the answer to. A gentleman wrote to me and said that he and his wife are looking for a place to live, and they wanted to rent either a house or an apartment. And the landlord said, are you vaccinated? And then proceeded to discriminate against them because they are not. I'm not sure it's legal to ask that, and I'm reasonably sure that the Federal Fair Housing Act does not allow landlords to discriminate based on your medical condition. You certainly couldn't do that against somebody who has HIV. I think you'd have a difficult time doing that to anybody who had any kind of medical condition, and I don't think it's legal for a landlord to say to you, tell me what your vax status is. I think the great answer is, I have all the immunizations I'm required to have. And on that note, let's go to Mark. Mark, thanks for listening on the Radio Northwest Network. What's on your mind today?
Well, I remember a few years ago, there was a situation in Portland during an Antifa riot where a person was being chased down and he pulled a pistol out and displayed it. To me, that was an act of self-defense. And I'm wondering if the Kyle Rittenhouse verdict might have an impact on that in the future.
It It may, the man you're talking about is a guy by the name of Mike Strickland. He has been on the show before. I believe, as you believe, that that was an act of self-defense. And I'll amplify it a little bit, Mark. Mike Strickland is a guy who is a journalist. He used the internet, and he used a site called Laughing at Liberals, and I think he's a good man. And he covered a lot of these thugs that go down and commit these acts, and he did it a long time before George Floyd died in Minneapolis. He did it because Occupy and other groups would go down and stage these events, and oftentimes they left with damage or they'd leave with people hurt. And he would videotape these, and about 6 months before the incident that you're talking about, he was actually tackled by a bunch of these thugs, and they broke his arm, and they broke up or stole his equipment. So you can imagine with that experience in his background, when four or five, it might have been four men, began advancing on him and in a threatening manner, and he had backed up and backed up. He didn't get into the middle of these crowds. He was videotaping them so that he could put the videos up. He pulled a pistol out, and that action was caught on camera by video, which we've seen. I mean, we've posted it on my sites. The pistol was actually out of the holster all of 4.5 seconds. And as soon as the people backed off, he put the pistol right back in the holster. No shot fired. And in fact, he makes the case the pistol was never pointed at them. It was pointed sort of down and low, like you would pull a pistol out and hold it with the muzzle pointed toward the ground, but out toward in front of you where the threat is coming from. And the people who saw it took the right message from it, and they backed off, which means it was a successful act of self-defense. He didn't fire a shot, didn't have to. The vast majority, over a million self-defense situations just like that in America every year, happen exactly that way. Somebody pulls out a pistol, they display it, the bad guy or girl, usually it's a guy, backs off, and the incident is over. The FBI and the DOJ say that it happens over a million times a year in the United States. And yet he was convicted of felony crimes. He can no longer possess a pistol until and unless, and I hope his appeals are successful. If his appeals are successful, he may someday be able to hold a gun. And for a time, the judge actually, it may still be true, that he's ordered to stay away from these events. So he's silenced as a journalist. He's disarmed as a citizen. And all he did was pull the pistol out for 4.5 seconds. And he stopped himself from being attacked for a second time. Does that make sense?
Yeah, it just seems like he's got a very good constitutional position, and that somebody, it'd be sure nice if somebody carry the water to the Supreme Court for him, but I know
they are. Well, they're pushing it. I can't remember exactly when his is going to come up for consideration by the Supreme Court. I wish they would take it up. I kind of think they probably won't, because the Supreme Court is taking up a number of other, or at least one or two significant Second Amendment cases. And usually if they're already taking up one significant Second Amendment case, the one that out of New York, they're not likely to take up a second one. But Mike Strickland's a great example of why it's very dangerous to be in a liberal city, because even your right of self-defense is usually gone. And that was under a previous prosecutor. I have no doubt that the current prosecutor in that county, in this case it was Multnomah County, would probably be happy to send him to jail if he possibly could. And that's a real disservice to American civil rights. Have a wonderful, happy Thanksgiving, and thank God for all the blessings that he showers on this wonderful, exceptional country of ours.